Page Turners. We have a very special guest to talk about the greatest road trip story of all time. We're talking Alan Moore's Providence Trilogy. And as always, I'm Poet Air. And joining me as always is Jack. And we have our very special guest, Aditya Pidikar, back to talk about this book since we kind of...
Hello.
We went on one of your last episodes. We talked about our love of Alan Moore in this book and kind of just went into our love of... I got to say, before we even talk about this book, I have a love of Lovecraft written things not written by Lovecraft. Like people that took Lovecraft art. And, you know, yeah. I love this book series. I absolutely love In the Mouths of Madness. I love all the kind of horror stories that have come out using Lovecraft's, you know, mechanics, but creating their own story. You got me to read Stephen King's Revival, which I won't get too much into it to spoil the experience, but absolutely.
Yeah, but it's in this tradition. Like if you liked Revival and you like Lovecraft, I have another recommendation for you, which is Laird Barron's short story collection, The Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All.
I'll definitely get that too. That sounds great.
It's one of the finest modern Lovecraftian horror collections that I've read. Like it takes Lovecraft's like uncaring cosmos sort of, and then expands it to kind of include like different kinds of Americana than Lovecraft had.
Nice. So almost like really nice. Get to go to more places, like I would assume then Lovecraft, maybe even.
Well,
maybe
for one thing, it's set in the Pacific Northwest rather than in New England.
That's even better for me, where I grew up.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And secondly, so Laird Barron calls his own cosmos his carnivorous cosmos. So it's like Lovecraft's uncaring cosmos kind of thing, like existential horror kind of thing. Except it's like a little more, it has a little more intention to it, sort of.
Nice.
Yeah. But like, yeah, it's definitely in the same tradition, and it's definitely got that discomfort with human existence and like what our destiny is in the universe, so on. It's that kind of stuff. Yeah. Really good stuff.
It makes me sweat, like in Revival especially, and I can only imagine with the name like The Beautiful Thing That Awaits Us All, the kind of things you can look forward to.
Yeah. I was Dan Waters actually recommended that to me because I think I was talking about Lovecraftian horror and like how there is like, while Lovecraft was definitely racist, misogynistic and all of those things, yeah, there is a certain things that like, it's not like cosmic horror existed before him, but he definitely codified like some of the most important elements of it. So there's no point kind of trying to run away from his influence.
Yeah, as this book will point out. There was Chambers and Beers and people like that, but he definitely took kind of the small parts of that and created something completely unique.
The whole idea of tying the cosmic horror to your own anxieties, that's a very Lovecraft thing. Like, and his anxieties just happen to be about other races of people.
Yeah.
But if you kind of use that specific idea, like, you know, use cosmic horror to explore your own anxieties, you definitely get a lot of interesting stuff. And I think also, like, as we'll probably talk when we reach Neonomicon and Providence, like there is a case to be made that horror should be exploring some uncomfortable stuff. Like it should, like, I mean, I don't mind that some horror is problematic. Like, I don't mind the idea that, like, for example, the horror at Red Hook. It's fascinating to see that person's mind. Like,
yeah,
it's like, oh, that's horrifying. Like, that's just, what are you doing, man? Yeah. So, and it's interesting. Like, it's like, I'm sure it's a curio probably. Like, it's not, I don't really necessarily want to read people's racist creeds right now, but like somebody writing that in the 1920s and like me getting to read it, it's interesting.
It definitely is. I mean, and even with these books, I feel like what people call problematic are just really horrifying things, and they're even more horrifying because they're things that actually exist in our world that are not usually shoved right into our face. I mean, they may not be done in the most realistic manner, but they're definitely things that occur. And so having to...
Moore's entire philosophy about Lovecraft on this in this trilogy is that, you know, Lovecraft talks about a lot of things hidden by the veil or something like that, or nameless horrors. And Moore is like, let me name all of them. Let me unveil all of them.
Yeah.
Let me show exactly what he was talking about. Like, for example, like you know, nameless rituals. What the hell do nameless rituals mean? Like, if there's sex happening there, like, a lot of that might not be consensual sex. And, like, so then obviously there is reading between the lines of Lovecraft, you can sort of excavate these things, and then Moore decides to put them on the page.
Yeah, right.
That's sort of what he's doing there. Yeah, but we could sort of. Where do you want to start? Like, we could start with the courtyard short story, because that's the whole thing.
Definitely. Maybe tell an overview first for our listeners who have not read this, or is their first time hearing about it. Is Alan Moore created this trilogy of stories that kind of all coalesce in Providence, which is this huge epic that's full of prose and just normal panel comic books. And it's literally such a fascinating journey. Like, before we get into the whole series, I got to say that I've never read a comic before with that much prose, which the prose keeps getting bigger, bigger and bigger, like longer and longer. Like, the first issue, it's a couple pages. The next issue, it's like 8 pages. The next issue, it's like 10 pages.
It's like 17 pages.
Yeah, 20 pages.
Yeah.
And it just keeps going. And, like, it got me so invested, and it really helps the story. Like, about halfway through my first time reading it, with what he was experiencing and how he was writing it, I kind of, like, had an idea of where the story was going, because I was like, oh, I've read Lovecraft. I see what's happening now. These things are familiar to me. And I was like, but Robert Black's writing it all down, not H.P. Lovecraft. And I'm like, well, somehow they got to cross paths, because this is exactly stories I've literally read by Lovecraft. And it's such a thrilling ride. And there's three books. There's first The Courtyard Short Story, which you have a protagonist named Aldo Sachs, who's very much Lovecraftian character, basically like a racist special agent investigating murders that don't make sense.
And asexual.
Red Hook and asexual, yeah.
Sort of asexual.
Yeah. And then basically that pivots into Neonomicon, basically people dealing with the aftermath of that story, which then leads us to Providence, which is way back in the past. And all of this is set, very interesting to me, in alternate New York, or alternate world, alternate East Coast. It's not the world we inhabit. It is, but with little
changes.
There's
a funny thing about that. I want to talk about that a bit when we get to it.
Yeah. One of the big points of when we get to it, too, is something that happens early on in Providence. And then, like, the first time I read it, I was like, did these places exist? And I had to Google it. And I was like, okay, no. Because, I mean, the way it's told, it's very much like our world, but not. But for a moment, I was like, did I just not hear about this in history class? Did these places exist in Central Park and in parks in New York? Without giving too much away. And I really like that he weaves all these different worlds together. But The Courtyard starts it off where it's like a knight in Red Hook. Aldo Sachs is investigating murders that are tied to do with basically a nightclub at an old church and a new drug, which leads him into investigating Johnny Carcosa, who's maybe my favorite character of all three books. He's always very shortly used, but each time, like,
it's so striking. So the first time a friend of mine got to Providence number 10, they literally sent me a screenshot of that particular panel.
Oh, yeah.
And they, like, DM'd me, like, what the fuck is this? What am I reading? You'll know which panel it is when you get to it.
When you read it, you'll get to it. And he's such a character, like, surrounded by dark energy, because he gets so many different Lovecraft characters and creatures that come out in these stories. But I would say he's almost like, I wouldn't call him good, because I really don't think he cares about good or evil.
He's such a nice guy. Like,
he's a very nice character. Yeah, he's so nice and polite. He's nice to Aldo the entire time. He's very nice and polite to Meryl all the way through her storyline.
And he's incredibly nice to Robert Black.
He's incredibly nice to Robert Black. It's just, and that really, I found so much fascination with that when I was in high school with Chambers and read, like, The King in Yellow, just because I knew it influenced Lovecraft so much. And I came fascinated, like, is Carcosa a real place? And just seeing a character named straight after Carcosa is great. And he almost seems like a punk rocker he has half his face covered with a yellow sheet. And I feel like many comics after these comics have used a similar character who I feel like is based directly on Johnny Carcosa. Like, Wolf specifically, but Alice Cott. I don't know if you've read, I love Cott, nevertheless, but there's a character.
I mean, I've worked with Alice.
On a bunch of books. That's awesome. Yeah, he's super. Yeah, he's awesome. And he has a character, I think, in Wolf that has to be based off Johnny Carcosa. I'm not sure. I mean, but he has a character that's very similar. He has the same kind of mumble talk. He doesn't have the mask. He just has, like, half octopus face. and like kind of dresses like
that could easily be more inspired by Mazikeen from The Sandman and Lucifer, who also has like half a non-human face. And
that's
talks
true.
Like
yeah, Mazikeen is very, very, very. It is a Lovecraftian character. That's why. I mean, it might not be related at all. Maybe he's never even read in these books.
Oh, I mean, I think Eilish is definitely very interested in Lovecraftian literature and probably has read Alan Moore's stuff.
I would assume so. But
So do you want to do a plot summary of it, or like do you just want to dive into...
I would just talk, because we're going to have so much to do. I talk about maybe how we feel about each part, because I think a plot summary for each is going to be hard, but it's up to you guys too.
I mean, I think I can summarize them in like... in short, perhaps. So the courtyard is like Michael said, it's about Aldo Sachs investigating these murders, and this is happening in an alternate version of New York, which has like these domed cities and things like that. And then he finds out what's actually causing these murders, and then kind of becomes a prey himself. And in Neonomicon, you discover that he's been committed. He himself became like a murderer because of this. And he's been committed, and there are new murders happening, which are kind of on a similar vein. And Merrill Breers is an agent who's sent to investigate this stuff. And then essentially they fall prey to Lovecraft's cosmos. Like, the idea in both of these stories is that, actually all three of these stories, is that some like unknowing comparative innocent suddenly is confronted by Lovecraft's cosmos and falls prey to it. Right.
And you did such a good job of that. I would have took 25 minutes to just try to explain what you just did. Very, very quick to the point. I appreciate that. Like, by the time you got so narrow, I was like, oh wow, he's right there. Okay.
Cool. I mean, I could like it. The actual plot is something I think the reader should probably discover.
I agree. Yeah.
And Providence is essentially. Yeah, Providence is essentially a prequel as well as sequel to Neonomicon, because. Like the structure is very interesting, where like the first 10 issues are the story of Robert Black, who again is an sort of innocent who has a trauma happen to him and then goes into like essentially, like Michael said, it's a road trip through Lovecraft's stories. And then he finds out that he has a role to play in bringing Lovecraft's horrors about. And then issues 11 and 12. Like issue 11 itself is like a journey through a Lovecraftian 20th century, because you kind of follow Pardon me?
I said I love that. Oh, it's a fantastic issue. I always like playing music to it, like just because it seems like any kind of like times going by music, and just see all the ramifications of the first 10 issues.
Oh, and it's a record that's mentioned. It's a record that's mentioned in like Providence 1 or 2. Like it's also a callback.
Yeah, because you see the record keep spinning, which is to tie into another scene. It's everything is just working so well. Stories.
And issue 12 is essentially the apocalypse has happened. Lovecraftian horrors now rule the earth. And what is humanity's place in this cosmos is essentially the plot of Providence number 12. So what I love about Providence is it's that this thing of, I remember I read Providence 10 when it was coming out. And then I was like, okay, the story is done. How do you have two more issues left? Yeah. Like, this is it. And then I had to wait 6 months for issue 11 and 6 more months for issue 12.
Those are some of the greatest waits in comics. I mean, it's frustrating at the time, but then it's so rewarding. I mean,
yeah, but I finally got to experience that thing of like, okay, what happens next? Like waiting for an important event in comics that you know is important. I think I would like to explore what I was talking about earlier, where you know all of these things are happening in an alternate version of America, right?
Yeah,
and this is an America which basically has. The elements from Chambers' stories, you know, that's like the domed cities and the suicide gardens, like, you know, gardens in which you kind of go and there's a place where you can, what's it called? Exit garden. Yeah, exit garden.
Exit garden, yeah, the death chambers, yeah.
So those are references to stories from Robert Chambers. I wonder if Moore had not mentioned those things in the Courtyard short story, would he have actually tried to use them in Neonomicon and Providence? Because did he only feel bound to them because, so basically, does this happen in an alternate version of America purely because he dropped those references in the original short story and then kind of was stuck with them?
And like the first few pages too of Courtyard.
Yeah, exactly. Or would he, maybe Providence could possibly work in a slightly different and just as good way if, like, it was happening in our version of America and then he meets Lovecraft and all of those things. Or, but because it's happening in an alternate version of America, it's kind of a surprise when he meets Lovecraft.
Yeah. It's very surprising
when Lovecraft exists in this. So
you get a good amount of time with them. Each one has a different feeling to me. Like, Courtyard is like my ideal. Like, it's a short story. I still haven't read the prose, which Aditya has been recommending, but the original, the short comic is such a perfect late night read for me. It's not too long. It gets you in that nice little sinking feeling of outside horrors lurking in, things we don't know or mind can't handle. And then Neonomicon starts out investigating that more and then just goes into very graphic, real-world horror that happens but involving Dagon and mythical creatures. And then I love that. It's definitely a visceral experience, which, Chaz, Arthur Coast, who didn't make it, say he couldn't finish Neonomicon just because it got to, the infamous parts of the story. And
well, here's the funny thing. Like, it's entirely possible that Moore himself hasn't actually read the comic. because in an interview I read that he read issue one with the artwork. And then when he was working on Providence, he read through the scripts for issues two to four. So it's entirely possible he's not actually read the comic.
He actually was like, I'm not going to.
Yeah, it's like too unpleasant for me. It's fine. Like, it's legitimately an unpleasant comic.
It creates a strong character too. Like, what Meryl's put through and kind of her endurance through all of it. And then coming out kind of like,
You're always sympathetic to her. And what happens at the end to her feels unfair. Like, it feels like it makes you angry what happened to her, right? And then I feel like at the end of Providence, Moore is basically saying that, yeah, I agree with you. It was unfair. It was incredibly unfair what happened to her. So now it's going to happen to all of humanity.
Yeah, it's what she began and is going to spread out to the whole world. Like, what literally is birth, in that event will affect everyone in the world. And then Providence
there's that moment in Providence number 12 where Providence number 11, I think, where the FBI investigators are talking about how the world is changing, but they seem strangely okay with it.
Yeah, they
and that's
changing.
Exactly what happened to Meryl Breers at the end of Neonomicon, where she was pregnant with Cthulhu and she knew it and she was okay with it. But she's wondering at the end, where like, am I genuinely feeling like this, or is my kid just making me feel like this? Right? Has my mind been taken away from me as well? And then by the end of Providence, like, the entirety of humanity has had the same thing happen to them.
Yeah, they completely become like normalized to it. So at one moment they're horrified, and then the next moment it's like it's always existed that way. That's the only world they know. And such a vast change. Some people it's happening to you slower, but most of the agents, it's just like they're talking about the things happening, and then the next panel or next page is this. These things have always existed. It's how the world is. Providence itself, that story is like, it has like, that's my like, it sounds bad because a lot of bad things happen in the story, but that's my like comfort food kind of horror telling. Like, that revival also hit for me. That's the kind of like horror that I feel at home with. Every time I read it, I take like different stuff from it. And really, it is a road trip story to me. Like, it might be my favorite road trip story just because you get to see Robert go to all these places. And
like in a road trip, once in a while, the connections are very tenuous. Like, why he goes to the next destination? It's not always very sensible. But
he really enjoys his time with the people he meets, too. Like, he's people that have connections that deep and terrible things he completely enjoys their time with. He's completely oblivious 90% of the story to what's happening to him.
Yeah. That is why the commonplace entries are very valuable, right? Because... Yeah. Most of his denial is kind of shown to you, like how he rewrites the events that happened to him. and he rewrites and tries to make sense of them. Yeah.
Without giving too much plot details, The second issue, he wanders somewhere he shouldn't, and he sees something unspeakable.
Yeah.
And then he just wakes up, and they're like, oh, there's a gas leak down there.
Gas leak, yeah. No, and there's that point where he actually essentially loses 3 weeks. And it's like what happens? It's very mind-bending, like that whole sequence of, like, I think it's like over 2 issues, right? Where the end is like he's finally seeing himself arrive in the town.
Yeah, 5 and 6. Yeah, the issues that really jump in
time. It's just it's so viscerally depicted, and then he talks himself out of it again. Like, it's just always he's gonna talk himself out of it.
That's actually one of my favorite Lovecraft stories, which I'm able to read a lot, is Dreams in Witch House. And literally 5 is just Dreams in Witch House, but he's experiencing it, because that's a lot of how Dreams in Witch House arrives. A guy arrives in Manchester, but he loses.
I haven't read that story.
So it starts out kind of similar. It's a guy who's traveling to Manchester, and he gets picked up by a random guy who looks kind of like a rat, and then he falls asleep, loses time, and he starts staying at the witch house, renting stuff there. He keeps hearing basically scratches in the wall, and then he comes and sees, like, the woman that runs the business feeding this giant rat, who's the same person that picked him up in town and drove him to the inn.
So it's literally the plot. Okay.
But my first time reading it, that's when I realized what was happening in the story, because I was like, he's literally experiencing Dreams in Witch House. Like, I didn't know at the time if Lovecraft was going to come into it, or is it some weird world where that exists and he's experiencing it. So we weren't at the Lovecraft part.
For me, that was the Wheatley issue. For me, that was the, like, the John Devine and Wheatley, you know, those the Obadiah, Obed Marsh. Chapter where, like, there are these two brothers, and, like, I remembered the Lovecraft line of, like, his brother is he resembled his father more.
Yeah, yeah.
That line, and I was like, hang on, that's that. And then when I realized that, wait, okay, this is what Providence is doing. That's cool.
And do the Commonplace book, like, the more he's writing in that, and the Commonplace book is used so well, not only to add prose and add to what we're experiencing, because literally every prose is just Robert telling in his own words what we just read as readers, him experiencing that, but him also trying to explain away in denial what happened. And now, even when, like, really bad things happen, he'll try to explain it as, it didn't happen that way, I was dreaming, that couldn't have possibly happened. And you as reader being like, Robert. And one of the best features I see, which I can tell without giving away too much, is I'm Polish, and there's a little old Polish woman. She might not be Polish, but she reminds me of a little old Polish woman that literally is in the courtyard in front of the church, and then she pops up in the second chapter of this book when he first sees there, and she just keeps popping up in the story. And I love that when he finally realizes he's just experienced terrible things, he just sees her in that watchtower staring at him. Yeah. Like, he's a lurking symbol of his sanity.
That's Carcosa's mother from Neonomicon.
Yeah. It's Carcosa's mom, But she just reminds me of just, like, a little Polish woman, like, Carcosa's mom keep on popping in, and he's just, when he finally, like, dawns on him all these horrible things have actually happened, and he realizes he's probably not going to survive, and he's writing that desperate letter to Malone, and he just looks up, and she's just in the watchtower, and it's getting closer and closer, and then it just breaks into full-on psychedelia, like, the worst trip. That's the trip you've
ever
had.
That is such a fantastic sequence, man.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that is just, like, incredible. That sequence reminds me, one of the things that I really feel about this series is what Moore is doing in relation to Lovecraft, because Moore himself believes in these things, right? Like, they form a core part of his magic, right? That the idea that the universe is a four-dimensional solid, that we are, like, I mean, if we were viewed from the, like, a dimension above us, we would look like these caterpillars that are kind of traveling through time, right? Which is exactly what happens when Breers and Aldo Sachs meet in the asylum, and Aldo Sachs says, like, we are all on Leng. That's Moore's own philosophy. The idea that words are magic, like, language changes reality, and that is the basis of his worship, right? Like, that is the basis of what he thinks of as his magic. The idea that, like, a reality, like, there is an underlying reality, And like, so he talks about the Terence McKenna, I think, talked about how like the world was psychedelic before language. Like language is how we structure the world, and that in turn affects how we see the world. Like I see this as a plant because I call it a plant. And if I like, so our experience of the world without language is incredibly psychedelic, is what Terence McKenna says.
I love what McKenna. Moore also believes. Thank you.
And that's also like, that's providence number 12. Like that's, once the reality is unveiled, it cannot be described in language. It is psychedelic. Right. So I find it very fascinating how Moore is essentially paying tribute to Lovecraft through his own version of like, this is how I see the world. And if Lovecraft could see the world my way, this would be it. So it's almost like he's handing over his own vision of the world as tribute to his antecedent. Like, so after critiquing Lovecraft for like so long in Neonomicon and the first half of Providence and in The Courtyard, all of those things, he's just like, you know what? He might be all of those things. He might be racist. He might be misogynistic. He might be like, you know, scared of the world in general, like all of those things. But like, he is a master of some kind, and that's a tribute from like, almost like a student's tribute to his master, right? Like, you can use my tools to tell your stories. And I find this like, it's a beautiful relationship. Like, it's a complex relationship. Like, Moore is basically saying, like, he's nowhere denying the problems with Lovecraft stories, but like, he's seeing the value in them. And like I love the fact that he's essentially given his worldview over to Lovecraftian horror for a little while, you know? And the funny thing is, do you remember Ultra Comics? Grant Morrison wrote The Multiversity, right? And Ultra Comics is an issue essentially, which is a comic that takes the form of a spell. And it's an evil spell, essentially. Like, it's not a good spell. And it's a spell that's going to be dispelled by the end of the Multiversity thing. But I remember reading that and I was like, well, Morrison believes all of these things, right? Like, Morrison believes that, like, you can kind of create a spell in the form of a sigil, or like a comic can be a spell, and so on. And I was like, okay, this is technically an evil spell. This is not a good spell. According to your own philosophy, this is an incredibly irresponsible thing to do. Yeah. Right? Like, I personally don't believe in it, but like, you believe in it, right? And I think I was genuinely like, okay, you know, that's like, I mean, I think a little less of Morrison after that. But in this case, I don't feel like Moore is disrespecting his own point of view by doing this. Like, he's not, like, I find those two things comparable, but very different, where Moore is essentially showing that, oh, this is my worldview. And because I just like Lovecraftian horror enough, I'm going to try and figure out what the horrifying version of my worldview would be. And I'm going to present that to you. Right. So it's quite fascinating. Like, I feel like Neonomicon and Providence are very interesting to me in that particular context of what Moore actually believes and like his magic. Yeah. But I think he also, it's true, but he also states that that's what Lovecraft has been doing for the last 100 years anyway. Like, that's the whole point, that the reason Lovecraft is the redeemer is that he's going to write about these things and they're going to become infections in people's minds. And it's interesting, like in Moore's writing, the perfect, like the parallel to this, like Providence number 12 is actually Promethea number 36, which was again an apocalypse in the literal sense, which is an unveiling, a revelation. And that's what Providence number 12 is as well, right? Like, it's essentially the underlying reality is uncovered. So when Moore did his version of the apocalypse, it was sort of like a similar thing where something was uncovered. But in that case, it was a happy ending. Yeah, no, that's very interesting because, in Lovecraft, I think it's straightforwardly stated as the future. Like, this is going to be the future where the old ones are going to come back and, you know, all of those things. In Moore's version, it's essentially like a rewriting of the universe. And like you said, humans are causing it. Like humans are actually bringing it about. No, it actually reminded me, like the reason I found that interesting was that I actually wrote a story like that once where it's for a Doctor Who spin-off series called Faction Paradox, where, Hindu mythology has these things called yugas, which are like eras of, like they are aeons, and they're kind of like, okay, one aeon is like 13,000 years, the next is like much longer, and we are supposed to be in the last aeon, which is Kali Yuga. And I kind of reposited them as, you know, rewritten versions of the universe rather than like these, rather than actually units of time. Yeah. And like more does something similar there. Like he's saying like, you know, like Rillet is like, it's not an actual like place. It's not like everything will be Yugoth. It's not like something that will happen in the future, but essentially like the universe will be rewritten to accommodate this. It's published now. I don't know if the anthology is in print anymore, but I can send you I can email you the story. Yeah. It's a story called Dharma Yuddha, which is essentially I rewrote the Mahabharata to be like a science fictional event with time travel and time-based weaponry and like a lot of stuff like that. And essentially the story was that the story was essentially like Krishna is the villain, and Krishna is like he's a bomb that is going to explode and kind of bring about the rewriting of the universe, exactly like in this story, actually, weirdly enough. So Moore ripped me off, like, because I wrote that story like 6 years ago.
Moore totally read that and was like, I have an idea now. That's really cool. You use Hindu mythology that way.
I'll email it to you guys.
I would definitely love to read
just
it.
Drop me your Hindu email mythology very,
very fascinating. I would love to read that. Speaking of McKenna, which you brought up a moment ago, something about all these untold cosmic horrors in all of Lovecraft's work definitely remind me of like when in my youth, when I experimented with psychedelics, weird things I experienced when I heard things in my head that weren't there or experienced some complete shifting of the universe. Then I think first I'm like, oh, I hope that was something like good. Like it was teaching me my way. And then I'll read like this or Revival and go, oh, but it could have been that. what if it was mother?
I've had a scary trip once, and after which I literally couldn't read fiction for 3 months because I kept thinking I'd fall into the story. Yeah, I had an overdose of edibles, which was like I apparently had 8 times the dose that I should have had. And I had like it was like a 6 hour long reality breaking kind of, you know, ego death, et cetera, kind of journey. One of the moments was this where like I'd forgotten language and I had literally had to shape the words in front of myself before I could think of the word itself. And yeah, it was very, I was at my parents' place.
Ego deaths are crazy.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No, but these trips are like, I mean, you know, the reason some people do these things is that they feel like there's an underlying reality to the world that, you know, you're not seeing, and that psychedelics will show you this reality in some way. And yeah, and that's it's an interesting thing. Like, I don't know how far I kind of believe in those things. Those things have happened to me, but like, I mean, I literally had, in the same trip, I had this moment where, like Morrison, there were these aliens that were kind of calling me outside the universe. And in that moment, I was like, you know what? No, I'm good. I have a nice life that I've built for myself. It's fine. Like, no, you guys go ahead, please. So I do wonder what would have happened if I'd said yes. And see, there's definitely some reality to the idea that enforces your vision of the world. Like I was watching a video today about how, it's this person's theory, but I don't know how true it is exactly, but he was talking about how like languages which do not have gendered verbs and gendered anything other than gendered pronouns they tend to be more progressive when it comes to gender, which is because it's a theory, and like I don't know how true it is, but I'm sure the idea of like if I can describe something, obviously that thing is far more real to me, right? So if if my language itself is agnostic towards gender beyond what I specify, the language is also going to be much more receptive to like the idea of multiple genders and, you know, all of these things. So I'm multilingual, right? Like I obviously understand Marathi, Hindi, and English, and a couple of other Indian languages. Urdu, for example, has, you know, you can, you're specifying your gender when you're making an I sentence as well. Like, so in English, I would say, I went there. My gender doesn't enter into it at all, right? But in Hindi, you would say, main wahan gaya or main wahan gayi, which is like two different gendered sentences, depending on your gender. And the thing is, in Urdu poetry, this plays a huge part because a lot of it is devotional poetry. And you are feminizing yourself to kind of pay obeisance to a masculine god, right? I mean, while that's obviously we can discuss if that's like not problematic or anything, it does allow you to sort of specify yourself as a kind of a gender. And that's something I always find missing when I'm writing in English. There are certain things that I would love to say that cannot be said in English and without like these very clumsy structures, like where I have to specify what I'm talking about. You know, or even like German, yeah, like German has this idea of like Duzen, right? Like, so you can, like, if somebody's in front of me, they can either be a Z or a Du. A Z is like formal, respectful. Du is like closer. Like, it's like a, so it's like you and thou kind of thing. And the, you don't have that in English, right? So like, there's no idea of like, oh, I use the formal you or I use the informal you, right? So that obviously changes certain things. And Marathi and Hindi also have that. Like Hindi has like three different versions. Like there is like a completely respectful one. There is one where you are close, but you're not like intimate. And there's a third you pronoun for the intimate version. So like, obviously then language changes it. Japanese has that. A lot of Indian languages have that. Yeah, so... And those things do shape the way you see the world, the way you interact with the world. Even color, like, I mean, there's a controversy about this idea of whether Greeks could see the color blue or not. Because none of their literature has blue in it. So, like, for example, the sea is called a wine dark sea. And, like, there's no point at which, like, the sea looks like wine, right? So like, what do they mean exactly by that? And some people think that that is just a colorful way of saying it. Like that's not really supposed to be taken literally. But there are other people who say that, no, they saw the sea like that. And, but it is true that, let's say if a language has, see, for example, red and pink, those to people who speak English, those are different colors, right? But pink is just a paler version of red.
Yeah.
Right. So it could be easily be called pale red. But because you say pink, then you have more nuance when it comes to like what is between pink and red. Because you kind of you have those differences nailed down. So there are languages which have a separate color for blue green, like, you know, a mixture of blue and green. Languages where that's literally a separate color. So then like, do they see differently? Like, you know, there's a lot of like exploration done about these things. And that, I mean, that's like Moore is clearly interested in those things as well, in a way that Lovecraft probably wasn't.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about how much of how we shape our world just through language and how we interpret things. Like just you talking about someone else can interpret it completely different. And how much is our, to get into your book with James, how much is our will and determination and interpretation influence?
There's a couple of things I read about, like, there are two things that I read about different languages that kind of fascinate me. One is, I think, about an African, like a ancient tribe in Africa, and one is about like some people in South America. So the African tribe, apparently the word for, like, in their idea, the past is in front of you and the future is behind you. Like you're falling backwards through time, essentially. And I was like, okay, that must change your perception of time, right? Like we think of going forward in time, right? That must obviously like feel different. So I actually wrote a story, like one of my other like Faction Paradox stories involved like an entire culture which sees the past as like an ever increasing thing while the future is an unknown that you fall into because they don't see the future literally. And the other thing was there is a particular geographical location in South America, I believe, where all directions are in relation to a particular mountain. Like you don't say like north, south. It's like north of the mountain or south of the mountain. Right. Like, so your entire geographical sense revolves around this one particular location. So all your cardinal directions are like according to that. So like, and it like they actually found that people could sort of like, if they took people into helicopters, blindfolded them and then made them travel to some place, they would still know where they stood in relation to the mountain.
That's crazy.
Because it was so ingrained in their sense of space.
They're like on compass. I mean,
this might be like there's a lot of hoax research that, you know, needs like a skeptical eye, which this might be. But like it's fascinating if it were true.
I can see it being true though, because like at least me, like I couldn't imagine I'd be blind, but I know like places I grew up and places I knew well, like I had enough in my brain that I think if I closed my eyes, I would still know the right direction to go. So I mean, if it's ingrained in you enough, it's like your own compass. So no matter if you're blindfolded or where you are, you know what direction you're pointing towards that point. So especially a huge mountain like that. Yeah. Real off the deep end now. If our consciousness somehow, let's just say, so when I didn't want to bring up too much, but on my 30th birthday, when I definitely tapped on some doors with psychedelics and experienced something that it's very hard for me to like talk about because it's hard to give it words. But definitely something was in my head. I was experiencing that. It wasn't me. I've never heard it again. And like I was seeing time shift. It was like I was rolling through time. So I mean, I was in the daytime, but then I roll on my back and it'd be night and then roll back and it'd be time. I was seeing algebraic symbols like sparked up in gold writing like in front of me. But I had this like, when it started, I just had a voice that started off with like, well, this is awkward. And like before I even heard the voice, it was like I became aware of something. You know, it was like I shouldn't be aware of it. So like I became aware of it. And the moment I became aware of it, there was like a deep fear because I was like, I should not be aware of this, but I am. And like the one thing I remember, which makes me think of like us, you know, influencing our reality, is I remember the voice. It said a lot of things to me, but the only thing I really remember is it told me, you control this, your reality. If you want to have a good experience, you need to have a good experience. Think good thoughts, want yourself to have a good experience and you'll have a positive experience. If you want to have a bad experience, that's fine too, because that's the experience you'll have because that's what your thoughts are and the kind of experience you want to experience while you're here. And that was just, I mean, imagine like real conspiracy theory, tinfoil hats. Like, let's say we all are some collective unconscious and we all kind of create this reality by our thoughts. What better way to brainwash and control the reality and the power of a few than through media? Release all this media, make everyone believe in the controlled reality that they want you to believe. And so then everyone creates this reality that the power wants you to believe so that they stay in power, the weak stay weak, and we stay just consumers. So, I mean, I don't know. Definitely fucks with things. So much misinformation is dangerous and it leads to deaths. I mean, even with like Christianity, like I always found it weird. I went to the church when I was younger, but I just found it weird to see so much hate from like books that the first book is not about peace. The Old Testament is about hate and punishment. But then the New Testament says the Old Testament is no longer valid, that's moot. And he says to love everyone and to treat everyone the same. And then he was a hippie that hung out with prostitutes and he was definitely not a virgin and he was out free willing. I mean, he got taken by the Romans because he got too drunk on wine. He partied with his friends. He was too hungover and that's how he got captured. But somehow people take these words of like a hippie and they're like, Jesus wanted us to hate the gay people. And I'm like, Jesus didn't want you to do that. And what's even more self-fulfilling is in Revelations, Jesus comes back to the churches and basically starts burning them down saying they were wrong. So not only are Christians doing this, they're self-fulfilling their own prophecy in the book where he comes back and says, you have ruined my word. You are wrong. And they're literally doing it. Like, you can read this book and how do you not read that and go, this might be what Jesus is talking about. He might be talking about us.
The prosperity gospel thing really doesn't make sense to me. I'm like, how can you read anything about the Bible and come to that conclusion that you getting richer is a good thing? Like, he's constantly getting richer. Yeah, like it literally says, like, I mean, and they twist it, right? Like, so that's interesting, right? Because you see the same media and like based on what you believe, you see the same thing differently. Like, I'm pretty sure right wingers are right now viewing the Kyle Rittenhouse trial very differently. Right. And it's the same video. Like, even if the video footage is the same, you're going to see it very differently. And you see it in India here with, like, I remember one of my uncles. So one of my uncles is a little bit of a right winger, like kind of a major right winger. So there was this video that, so one of my cousins shared a video of two Muslim celebrities and one Hindu celebrity in India dancing together. Okay. And it was a lovely video. He was just talking about, like, my cousin shared it to kind of show, like, oh, these are our, you know, that these are the people that we revere kind of thing. And they're also like letting their hair down and stuff like that. Right. My uncle went on this bizarre screed about one of the people, one of the Muslim celebrities, and started talking about how, like, oh, why doesn't this person pull his community up on things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Just random shit. And the weirdest thing was that particular celebrity actually does all of those things. Like, he's a vocal critic of fundamental Islam. He's a vocal critic of some of the regressive things that we see in, like, Islamic people in India and stuff like that. He's a really vocal critic of all those things. But to my uncle, this very innocuous video of three people dancing just looks different because of his point of view. Mm-hmm. Like, to him, this looks like somebody flaunting their religion or whatever. And it's just so bizarre. And I'm like, how do you see the same thing and just come to such a different conclusion?
And that point of view is created at some point, like what we're just talking about, controlling it. At some point, when your brain is malleable and it's a sponge, these things get put into their brain by someone else because they didn't just come up with these thoughts. Someone gave them these thoughts and it's ingrained in their brain. And it affects literally how they look at the world and effective how they look at people for the rest of their lives. And there's almost impossible to change it. I mean, unless, like, you're going to give them a massive, massive dose of psychedelics and just hope for the best. And maybe they'll have love and empathy for others. But
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Ian used to experiment with that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you see in a lot of things, I mean, caste is a big thing in India, right? And I see in Savarna is like what are traditionally privileged castes in India. You know, the oppressive caste, basically. And you see this whole thing of, okay, you know, somebody tells them caste discrimination is a bad thing, you know, talks to them about like progressive views about caste. And you can literally see them like hearing that you're saying that I'm a bad person.
Yeah.
And that's not being said. What is being talked about are structures, what is being talked about are like how things can be dismantled to make a more equitable world for everybody. But all that this person is hearing is that, oh, you are attacking me. You're saying I'm a bad person.
Well, and it's to keep us separated. Like, it's just miseducation and misinformation, because the one thing is we're way easier connected. There's way more in between us that is similar than not alike. And the problem is
the white working class has more in common with the black working class or like people of color of working class than with any rich people. Like, and they are dividing you. Like, they're telling you not to see the similarities between. So one of my friends once talked to me about, like, so I'm fairly vocal about progressive politics and things like that, right? Like left-wing politics. And one of my friends was like, so when you visit the UK, like, do you have any fights with white people about these things? And I'm like, no, because they are white working class people. Like, I have no issue with them. Like, they're like, we are more similar. Like just because they're British, They did not colonize India. Like, it was the fucking aristocrats who did that. Like, the middle classes did that. Most of my British friends are working class. Like, I don't have any complaints against them.
And I mean, my work is all working class. Like, we definitely work for someone that's well off. But I mean, my work is all working class people. And even in my work, is people of every color, like,
my boss and my team, they both are literally from India, and then working with us are Black people and of every race, Mexicans, and I'm white. And a lot of us have the same ideas, but others are more, you know, have the more right ideals. And I don't judge them at all. I would rather get along with them, but they look at me like I'm a commie. They think I'm like, they look at me like I'm a communist. Like, and I mean, I have nothing against communism. So whatever, if that's how you want to look at me, that's fine. But I mean, it's just like the way people look at each other. In the end, I'm sure we all want the same thing, which is good lives for us and our children. And we're all in the same boat. So, I mean, like, regardless of like, I hate to see, like, I'm so glad that DC is taking chances now and like doing the Jonathan Kent thing. But also, like, the one thing I hate is it gives people with the wrong idea a reason to complain and think like I'm wrong. My aunt, who's never read a comic in her life, came up to me and was like, why'd they have to make Superman gay? And I had to explain to her, I went, first of all, it's not Superman. She goes, no, I know, it's actually his son. And I said, well, then why is it matter? He goes, because they're shoving it in our face. And I was like, they're not shoving it in your face. And she was like, and can you believe you know, that
this is really funny to me. Because all these people who talk about forced diversity, like, they're like, oh, no, what you should do is you should make a new character and then you should make that character bisexual or gay. That's exactly what they did here. Yeah. And that's not good enough for you. Like, this is not forced diversity, right? Like, this character was created very recently, and the idea that he is bisexual was seeded for the last couple of years.
Yeah.
Right? This is exactly what you said you wanted. Like, this is organic diversity. But no, it's not good enough for you. They just don't want diversity.
And she was even more mad.
I mean, not your aunt specifically,
we
know who we're talking about.
Yeah. She was more mad they changed the American Way thing to a better tomorrow, and I just want to sit there and go, like, first of all, Superman's nailing. Second of all, he's saving people all over the world. And how are you against a better tomorrow? How are you against that? Which just basically means good to all. You're more for the American way? What does that even mean anymore? We're not in 1950s America. I don't understand.
Yeah.
It should be. The American way should mean a better tomorrow for all. This has quickly turned into politics podcast, but it's okay.
Basically, everybody should read Providence. We could talk about the thing, like, before we wrap up, we could talk about the thing, like, that there is some genuinely problematic stuff depicted in both
books,
Neonomicon and Providence.
Fair warning to you guys if you read it. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, like, trigger warning, like, massive, less.
Yeah, trigger.
Well, it's an Avatar book. I think that's
that's a trigger warning right there. You're gonna, there's no censoring Avatar. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like, there's a lot of even Moore talked about how, like, one of the things that he liked about working for Avatar was that, like, they have no content restrictions, so he could sort of figure out, like, how far he would want to go. And you know what, like, while I would never want to depict some of the things he did, like he and Burroughs did, I appreciate the idea that, like, I think American comics have very little sex in them. And I think there should be a lot more sex in American comics. And for the reasons that Moore states, which is that sex is a part of human life. And if you're going to try and depict all human life in all its colors, this should be one of those things.
On that topic, I want to add something in real quick to that, because they don't have enough in American comics or American movies. That I saw Eternals last night. People are mixed on it. I enjoyed it. It's very weird. But I was sat in a theater full of kids with their parents. And there's a sex scene in the movie, and it's not just like, oh, they did sleep. It's literally Richard Madden on top of Gemma Chan, and they're humping, and they're like grabbing each other, being, I love you. And it's like the kids all next to me, and their moms being like, what is going on? And I was like,
But don't you people have like ratings for that? Like, MPA ratings are for?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm sure in the PG-13, it probably says scenes of sensuality. So I mean, I just think no one expects it because they're so used to Marvel movies being kind of a certain formula. Which I think, for better or worse, I enjoyed it.
Which is a strange thing. Like, till I would say, like, the late 90s, a lot of theatrical movies in America used to have, like, reasonably, like, some nudity, like, a lot of sex and stuff. And then it just kind of went away, like, weirdly. And now it's all on TV.
Yeah, it's all on streaming now. And the movies that do have it have like a lot of it, and it ends up being NC-17 rated or known for that. You know what I mean? Like, known for that. But we need it more in comics. Like, why I love DC is it has the Black Label, and it's kind of one of the big two that gets to experiment more in the more adult stuff, which I really wish Marvel would bring back and have in their comics more. Have something that's more for that audience. I feel like Axel Alonso did it a lot. Like I'm a big Axel Alonso fan. I thought he did a great job when he was editor-in-chief at Marvel. He took a lot of chances. Ellison Lemire's Moon Knight run, X-Men run, and I know there's more I could think of than I'm thinking about right now, but a lot of chances were almost hewn to adult material because, like, Moon Knight is a psychological thriller from Lemire's. I mean, it's just a lot of chances, and it just seems like after that, and even the earlier period with Miller and Bendis and when Quesada was running.
Yeah, like the early Quesada period.
Yeah. And it seems like they just got rid of all that. They had that Punisher with Jason Burroughs drawing and Garth Ennis writing about, I think, 2 years ago, and it was kind of more adult-themed, and I don't think it was called KGB or Soviet. I think it was called Soviet.
Right.
And it was good. But then they never seem to want to go that route again. Or every time they do it, they do like one small series. It probably doesn't sell as well as the big books, and they just go, no, we're not going to do that anymore. And I feel like, at least with DC, they
But even let's take Image Comics. Image Comics doesn't like they do have their content restrictions, but they're fairly lenient. Like you can depict a lot of stuff at Image without getting into trouble for it. And like Saga has like full frontal nudity and things like that. But still, like a lot of Image Comics don't really have any nudity in them, like or light checks. And I'm a little puzzled by it because like they're supposed to be mature reader comics. Yeah, a lot of dong. Absolutely, lots of dong. Like, so he actually talks about a conversation he had with William Christensen where he's like, "Can I show erections?" And Christensen is like, "Yeah, sure." Like, "Can I show penetration?" And he's like, "Yeah, sure." He's like, "Really? I can show it. It's fine."
Before we get into the problematic stuff or the stuff, you know, just to kind of give you a forewarning, there is that other scene which is kind of graphic, but it's not as problematic because it's consensual sex. And it's when they're on the artifact in the church that makes them horny, and it's like Robert Black and that young
I just thought that was a nice scene. Like,
it's a great really scene, yeah. Like, you know, just sit there. No, that one's not at all. But I'm saying that one's not at all, but I just like that he has the ability to show that, like, a love scene between two men.
Exactly.
Completely
yeah.
consensual, and Robert's excited about it.
To give both Moore and Burroughs, like the artist. I mean, we haven't talked about Burroughs at all in this because, like, that's the collaboration
through
all
three
books, right? And we should. Yeah. But yeah, like both of them have, like, when it comes to assault, like depicting assault, they don't go like quite as graphic as you think they will. Like, it's not actually depicted on the panels.
Like, no, it's,
it is sometimes surrounded by.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes it's surrounded by consensual sex, so you think it's being depicted, almost, but it's not. Like, it's not actually, like, it's off-panel. Like,
it is off-panel,
it's only slightly
off-panel,
but it's off-panel, yeah.
I would say issue 7 or 6 of Providence is a little bit closer, but still off-panel. Like,
that's,
you see it. Beginning?
That's the one thing. Like, yeah, they do depict, like, an underage woman.
Yeah,
but I mean that's also again like
my
you look
old
at
man now, just to get everyone. She's possessed by
exactly like that's it's an underage girl who's possessed by an old man. Like, but also like that's still in Lost Girls territory, right?
Yeah,
you know, and
it happens in a lot of pros. Like we said earlier, a lot of pros like I said even earlier with King won't do it as much as like is that how that goes out? But like King has a lot of. Sex like that in his books with like
graphic
detail of like young people talking about like there'll be like a 13-year-old boy in the store and he's narrating and getting about how hard he got made by looking at a girl, but it's all prose. It's not
prose
right
there
in front of you.
I have had this discussion with friends where like, you know, most people I would say would be okay with like, let's say underage sex or whatever being depicted in prose because it's being described. And generally speaking, it's not erotic. Like, I mean, we're not talking about like kiddie porn or anything.
We're talking
about like regular literature, which happens to have like underage
characters. If anyone knows what happens in it, it's
it stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, King was asked about it as well, and he has his own clarification for that particular scene, right? And and the thing is, most people are kind of okay with that stuff, right?
Yeah. It's easier to digest.
And I've had
this
discussion with people about Images. Like, I understand that Images are in far more contentious territory, but drawn images. Like this is a whole pornography thing in the US, right? Like drawn images are qualitatively different from photographs. Right.
Yes, there but is, it does cause a lot of discussion here because a lot of people will draw pictures.
Same here. I mean, absolutely. Yeah. And definitely it's a thorny subject. Like I'm not even gonna say that there's a particular right opinion to be had here. But I do kind of fall under the thing where, like, you know what, if something is drawn and if something does not have a titillating purpose.
Yeah.
Like
intention kind of describes everything, you know what I mean? Intention, like, and this is a part of the story. If someone's intending to like create a pornographic image with art and put it on there, that's different. That's a completely different story.
That's very different.
Yeah.
Exactly. And yeah. I think this falls under that. And it's like, I know some people who, like, you know, all the people who rail against cancel culture would kind of classify this as brave or something like that. I don't think that at all. I don't think it's just a choice. It's purely a choice. It's a creative choice. And it's obviously somebody can completely disagree with it. But I think it's comparatively responsible. Like, I don't think either.
It's useful in the story because it's kind of the crack that hits Robert Black, where he's really now on the path to complete downward spiral. Like, he's kind of like a broken child after that happens. Like, the next storyline where he's literally just talking to a cosmic horror rat monster under the sewers, and he's just so broken.
It's completely shaken, right?
He's just so shaken. He just thinks it's the man he's with doing a different voice, even though he's literally in underground and like a subterranean place, but he's just so broken. He's literally like a child himself because he's just so shocked. Yeah. That poor cop.
And the horror of that moment where he walks into that bar and he says, like, I might have raped somebody, and the policeman says that you're not alone today, like, because there's a riot going on.
Yeah, not even like acknowledging him when he even tries to like admit to it. Yeah. And kind of have the guilt. The guy goes, you're not alone today. It's fine. And he just
that's the thing, right? Like, this is the most horrific things that happen in our world are humans doing these things to each other, right?
Yeah.
Like, they are like humans who would be perfectly normal on another day are like being completely horrific to each other in that. Yeah.
I mean, it really, it makes it so much more horrifying. Like, I think if they didn't have these and they went kind of like streamlined, it wouldn't be as horrifying journey for Meryl or as Robert. Like, to see Robert kind of that scene with, you know, Carcosa's mom, where he finally snaps and realizes everything I've seen is real. Everything I thought I've done is such a rewarding experience because you've seen him through this horrifying journey.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's.
I know. I think that's where I come to. Like, even about Neonomicon, like, I'm absolutely, like, I would never try and defend this. Like, I would never try and say that somebody should read this or something like that. Like, if you don't want to read it, it's perfectly fine. If you feel it's abhorrent, perfectly fine. Like, it's fine. Except, like, it is a horror book. It's supposed to make you uncomfortable. And I think, and it does it in the ways that he intends it. Like, it's not that it's making you uncomfortable outside of his intentions. Yeah. Right. Like, it's not like, it's controlled. It's absolutely under control. So I think that's like usually credit to Burroughs, about whom we've not really talked.
His art is fantastic in this whole series. I mean,
it's so deeply researched. It's like I found out, like, I was rereading it today. Today I saw that there is an image when Robert Black is looking out of a window in Salem, and he's seeing the same view that Meryl Breer sees in Neonomicon.
Neonomicon, when she's looking out the window in the apartment, the hotel. Yeah.
And I noticed that for the first time. I was like, wow, like, this is attention to detail. This is insane. This is fantastic.
No, I was going to say, I know Alan Moore is against film and it's almost unadaptable. Me, just personally, those are his scripts and adaptation. To, like, I would absolutely love a Providence mega series that had all these in it. Like, just like a 15-part series, in the beginning is Courtyard and Neonomicon, and then just the Providence journey. I mean, you'd have to change something.
I think they definitely would have to recast, like, change certain stuff. Like, maybe not really leave it out exactly, but, like, the depiction would have to change a lot because you're seeing real bodies on screen, you're reaching real people there, and, like, I wouldn't even necessarily want like an adult actress like playing some like just don't do that. Like
just don't.
Like for example, American TV has a lot of high school sex where like these characters are supposed to be 16 and 17, and they're depicted by like adults. But the age of consent in India is 18, right? And that really makes sense to me. So watching all of these TV shows where 16, 17-year-olds are like rapidly having sex.
In the West, where the weird laws are. But on our coast, it's that as well.
Yeah, but it just reads so weird to me. Like I watch these TV shows like, for example, even like Buffy. Buffy is supposed to be a 16 or 17-year-old having sex with like a... 150-year-old. Yeah, just like, what are you doing?
We're Twilight.
I mean, I've not watched Twilight, but no. But even the shows in which there is just like 16, 17-year-olds having sex with each other, like I'm like, why are you showing that? Like, what? I mean, I understand that you need to, yeah. But it's very weird watching like 25-year-olds play like 16-year-olds.
It's always 30-year-olds. I mean, you see.
I think that's why Euphoria made a lot of people uncomfortable, because it was actually younger people.
I have not seen it, but I know that it did. Yeah, make people uncomfortable. Yeah,
and it definitely skews into some points where it like feels like more titillating than it should be, or like at least that the creators aim that way. But I think that's like a balance problem. I don't think that's like an intention problem. I think that's it was a misstep rather than like they aim to make you uncomfortable. Like most of the time, the aim is to make you uncomfortable.
To bring up Twilight, like, it's just weird. Twilight gets brought up more now, but I mean, just a literal plot element of Twilight is there's a character that's the girl's best friend. His name's Jacob. He's completely displayed in the book. And what's funny is like, when those books are popular, I had friends that are all Team Jacob, and they're like, we love Jacob. And he's literally portrayed in the book as a controlling psycho. Like he wants to be with Bella. He wants to be with Bella.
But not for her daughter. Doesn't he imprint on her daughter?
Yes, I'm trying to get to that. Yeah. So he's first of all, but he's trying to control Bella. He forces a kiss on her by shoving her against a car in the book that she's not consensual with. She still stays friends with him. Then her baby's born and he imprints on her, which means that's his soulmate. She's a baby. Now, literally, he's like a 20-year-old at this point. He imprints on a newborn baby, not even a day old. So then the way they work around this is the baby's a new kind of vampire and she ages quick. So in a month, she's aged to a teenager. So very soon, she's going to be adult age. But she's still only 3 months old. Like,
yeah, that's... I remember. So my girlfriend likes the Twilight movies. Like, it's her guilty pleasure thing. Yeah. And she was rewatching them one time and I was like, wait, is that the imprint baby? And she's like it's Jacob playing with like what looks like a 4-year-old.
And he holds the baby.
He's giving her toys.
Like, he is. He's giving her toys. He's watching after her while she's aging. And he's like, I'll watch her. She's mine. And things like that. You're just like, and there's actually a book that is getting released. My wife just told me there's a book coming out this next year, which is about their romance from Renesmee, the girl's point of view. And it's called Moonchild, right?
Yeah. Renesmee, yes.
Yeah, they had to, it was eating her way out of their stomach, and they had to,
which is why he has to make her a vampire. They had or something.
Yeah, and then that's why they make her a vampire.
I don't know where Americans get off calling Japanese people weird.
It's entertaining. We watched all of them recently. Jasper is so funny. The guy playing Jasper, he's just like, that's his all acting cues is looking like.
Yeah.
It's just funny, people are still Team Jacob. And I'm like, first, he's abusive. He forced himself on a girl. And he's basically soulmates with a 3-month-old. And no problem that exists.
Yeah.
I know Taylor Lautner felt bad about the actor. And then they were trying to find ways around it. Because I know they were like, this is going to be hard to film, which is obviously hard to film. And then they were just like, well, we can't adapt it if we change it. And Stephanie Myers was like, you can't change it. I know the studio was like, what? They were very heavily trying to change what happens. And then she had the full creative control. I'm just like, you can't change my story. This is my story. And it's like,
Yeah, that's like a whole... I kind of grew up watching a lot of American shows, and that's the whole side of America that I was not aware of through these shows that I was watching. Like, because that's a whole, like, the Bible Belt conservative, like a lot of those things I was just not really aware of till much later. And I'm like, this is strange. Like,
yeah.
I mean, I'm aware of it now.
I got to cut out soon. So I don't know if you guys want to wrap up, which is,
I think we're good. I think we talked a lot about, I mean, yeah, we could do like a whole run through the whole thing step by step, but I think we kind of covered everything pretty much.
Yeah. Leave it for people actually to read it, which is nice. They get to read it. And I think a lot of our
We mentioned a lot of random stuff, but not really talked about anything really important.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like, I think Robert Black is one of Moore's most interesting characters. Like, it's just wonderfully rendered. Like, just his discomfort with himself as a gay half Jewish man.
Yeah.
And like in the 1920s, and like his own feelings of superiority, his own feelings of he's not perfect. It's like he's a wonderful flawed protagonist.
And
I really love how he sketched him out.
Like, while he goes,
like, even when he's writing prose, like, Moore is striking that balance of like writing slightly pretentious bad prose.
Yeah. In a way, it unravels. Like,
Moore is he's a master of voice anyway. Yeah. So, yeah.
I enjoy it with the warning that it does have some graphic problematic scenes. I highly recommend it.
Yeah, prepared to be uncomfortable.
Like, yeah, it's one of my favorite horror reads ever, and one of my favorite works by Moore. Not
for the faint of heart, but like, if you want to see what Moore thinks is horror, like, it's literally his image of horror. Like, over the three books, I would say he covers everything that Moore thinks about horror.
Yeah. It is.
I would say it's among like Moore's pantheon. Like, it's just,
I agree.
You know, Watchmen, From Hell, Promethea, like, this is absolutely in like the top five for me, but at least the top 10. Yeah.
Me, maybe even closer to the top. I love horror.
I think for me, it would be From Hell, Watchmen, Jerusalem, and then Providence.
Yeah. Those are all great. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not a big fan of V for Vendetta. Weirdly.
It's okay.
Like, I just don't like that book.
Yeah. I'm not a huge V for Vendetta person either, but to each their own.
Yeah.
Anyways, you're always a pleasure. It's so fun to talk to you. Always. Yeah.
Next one will be Pluto at some point of time when you cover it.
We'll definitely. We will do it. You can find us on Twitter at Outside The with a zero instead of O. You can find me at PoetAir33. And you can find Jack at Sin and then _ Aesthetics with the X at the end instead of a C. And where can they find you, Aditya?
You can find me on Twitter at Aditya B and my website at adityab.net, which I'm in the process of overhauling. And I also have a newsletter, which is in my pinned tweet. So you can just sign up there.
I am signed up. I am enjoying it. Also, I want to shout out...
I haven't posted one in a long time. I should really post
it. I can't think of his name right now, but the Osaka Mime Writer, I'm on his newsletter. I can't think of his name right now, which is terrible. We'll cut this out, Jack. But he went into like a huge rant about how the Aditya Bidikar method, about how you write down ideas in your cell phone. He was talking about how he's been learning how to write off that. I'm literally blown away. I just look up his name right now.
Even a method. It's just like the idea is that you write in your notes app, because if you're afraid of, like, you know, some writers are kind of afraid of words. Like, they want to kind of come out with the perfect words.
Andy.
I feel like if you write in your notes app, it's just notes, right? So like you can be rough. You can be as rough as you like and you get writing done.
I enjoy it because it's Andy Levy, and he just wrote his first book, was Osaka Mime. It just came out, so he's a very new writer. Yeah, and he went to like a long time, like five paragraphs.
I just wrote a whole short story in the notes app. Yeah, I just did it myself.
That's awesome.
Like a 4,000-word short story entirely.
His name's Andy Levy. I love Osaka Mime. It's a great debut book, and yeah, he definitely enjoys you. He wrote several paragraphs about how he taught him about writing, in his newsletter. And I was like, yes. All right, well... as always, thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Aditya, for
taking
part.
Could you forward me the newsletter, by the way?
I'll forward it to you right now. I'll send it on Twitter. Yeah. I got it. I'll send it to you.
Thank you.
Yeah. You're welcome. Yeah. And everyone take care, be good to each other, and turn the page and wash your hands.
Outside the pages.